Conservative? You bet. Controversial? Right again. It's time to squabble on the Jim Benson Show.
Hello, and welcome to another edition of the Jim Benson Show, conservative talk radio covering the issues that concern you here on the BBS Radio Network. If you'd like to call into the show, the phone number is 888-627-6008. That's 888-627-6008. A major development in the coronavirus pandemic took place late last week, and that was the President's Task Force on the Pandemic announcing its plan for a phased reopening of the U.S. economy, getting people out of sheltering in their homes and back to work. This is a critical, essential development in the view of many conservatives who believe that without a relatively fast reestablishment of the formerly booming American economy, we will be facing an unparalleled political, economic, and social disaster. Of course, many on the political left in this country want such a disaster, seeing it as an opportunity to achieve their dream of a socialistic utopia in America and world government. So it's not surprising to see Democrats, the Democrat-controlled mainstream media, and other leftist institutions engaging in endless scare tactics about the coronavirus pandemic to terrorize and dumb down the population into accepting a prolonged national shutdown, ostensibly to save lives, but more appropriately to gain power for the left. You see, despite their propaganda, the left really doesn't care about you. They see themselves as saving the world. If you get in their way, then you are disposable. Most of our political ruling class on the left are fabulously wealthy and, at least at present, relatively unaffected by the national lockdown and closing of businesses and commerce. That's a big reason why so many of them aren't worried about the upheaval a long-term national shutdown would bring. With this in mind, let's listen to parts of the White House Coronavirus Task Force briefing of April 16, in which the President, Vice President, and Task Force members – Doctors Deborah Birx and Anthony Fauci lay out their plan for reopening the country and discuss its three phases. The briefing itself lasted for well over an hour, and I tried to boil it down to those parts I thought were most relevant for my purposes here. My apologies if it's a bit choppy and here and there. It runs over 20 minutes, but in all, I think it conveys the essence of the hows and whys of the plan, which is pretty important. Play soundbite one, please.
Through this unified national endeavor, we have made great progress. You could really say incredible progress. Our experts and scientists report that our strategy to slow the spread has saved hundreds of thousands of lives. Models predicted between 1.5 million and 2.2 million U.S. deaths. If there was no mitigation, could have even been higher than that. And between 100,000 and 240,000 deaths with mitigation, it's looking like we will come far under even these lowest numbers. Thanks to our all-out military operation and the extraordinary devotion of our people, we believe we will experience far fewer deaths than even the optimistic projection, but there is no such thing as an optimistic projection on death. One person is too many. Our experts say the curve has flattened and the peak in new cases is behind us. Nationwide, more than 850 counties, or nearly 30% of our country, have reported no new cases in the last 7 days. Because of our early and aggressive action, we have avoided the tragedy of healthcare rationing and deadly shortfalls that have befallen many other nations, nations which, wherever possible, we are helping. In America, no person who has needed a ventilator has been denied a ventilator. We're making hundreds of thousands of ventilators. We've delivered thousands and thousands of ventilators to the states, and actually, it's been an incredible operation. We started with very little, and we ended with a lot. the United States has achieved a significant lower mortality rate than almost all other countries. Based on the latest data, our team of experts now agrees that we can begin the next front in our war, which we are calling opening up America again. And that's what we're doing. We're opening up our country, and we have to do that. America wants to be open, and Americans want to be open. As I have said for some time now, a national shutdown is not a sustainable long-term solution. To preserve the health of our citizens, we must also preserve the health and functioning of our economy. Over the long haul, you can't do one without the other. Cannot be done. To keep vital supply chains running, these chains have to be taken care of so delicately. They're delicate. The balance is delicate. We want to deliver food and medical supply. We must have a working economy, and we want to get it back very, very quickly. And that's what's going to happen. I believe it will boom. A prolonged lockdown combined with a forced economic depression would inflict an immense and wide-ranging toll on public health. This includes a sharp rise in drug abuse, alcohol abuse, suicide, heart disease, and many other dimensions of physical and mental well-being. Moreover, many patients have put needed medical care on hold, creating entirely new hazards for public health. Our country has suffered. The world has suffered. 184 other countries have suffered. Therefore, my administration is issuing new federal guidelines that will allow governors to take a phased and deliberate approach to reopening their individual states. I've dealt with them now a long time, and we've had a great relationship. Democrat, Republican, the relationship has been good. This strategy is based on hard, verifiable data. We took the greatest economy in the history of the world, and we closed it in order to win this war, and we're in the process of winning it now. Our approach outlines three phases in restoring our economic life. We are not opening all at once, but one careful step at a time. And some states will be able to open up sooner than others. Some states are not in the kind of trouble that others are in. Now that we have passed the peak in new cases, we're starting our life again. We're starting rejuvenation of our economy again in a safe and structured and very responsible fashion. Our strategy will continue to protect senior citizens and other vulnerable populations while allowing military and other groups of incredibly talented people to go about their real business and the business that's supposed to be hard at work at doing, and nobody does it better. Our military is the greatest anywhere in the world, and we're so thankful for what they've done. Healthy Americans will now be able to return to work as conditions on the ground allow. Instead of a blanket shutdown, we will pursue a focus on sheltering the highest risk individuals, so important. We're establishing clear scientific metric and benchmarks on testing, new case growth and hospital capacity that must be met before advancing to each phase, and that's each phase specifically in the reopening of our country. This is a gradual process. As the caseload in a state continues to go down, restrictions can continue to be eased and come off. Throughout the process, citizens will continue to be called upon to use all of their weapons in this war. Vigorous hygiene, teleworking when possible, staying at home if you feel sick, maintaining social distance, sanitizing commonly used surfaces, and being highly conscious of their surroundings. Those are our weapons, and they're very powerful weapons indeed. Governors will be empowered to tailor an approach that meets the diverse circumstances of their own states. Every state is very different. They're all beautiful. We love them all, but they're very, very different. If they need to remain closed, we will allow them to do that. And if they believe it is time to reopen, we will provide them the freedom and guidance to accomplish that task and very, very quickly, depending on what they want to do. We are also encouraging states to work together to harmonize their regional efforts. We'll have numerous cases where states have worked and will be working very, very closely together. As we reopen, we know that there will be continued hardships and challenges ahead. Our goal will be to quickly identify and address any outbreaks and put them out rapidly. If the virus returns in the fall, as some scientists think it may, possibly, these guidelines will ensure that our country is up and running so that we can likewise put it out quickly. At the heart of our strategy is the vital role of medical research, especially for therapies that will significantly improve outcomes for high-risk patients and reduce the need for urgent care. This will be tremendously valuable in allowing life to eventually return to normal. At least 35 clinical trials are already underway, including antiviral therapies, immune therapies, and blood therapies in the form of convalescent plasma. You've all heard about some of these events and some of these therapies. They've come a long way. What's been done in the last 4 weeks is incredible. We will also continue to expand our testing capacity. We have now completed more than 3.5 million tests, by far the most anywhere in the world. Areas of our country that have been hotspots have done much more testing on a per capita basis than South Korea. We've done more than South Korea, and South Korea has done a good job, but we've done more. We will continue to work with governors to advise them on how to conduct both surveillance and diagnostic testing. We have now distributed over 600,000 Abbott ID Now point of care diagnostic tests. These are tests that are done on site, and within 5 minutes, you know the answer, positive or negative. In recent days, we have seen a dramatic increase in the number of tests performed by hospitals and academic institutions, with more than 120,000 tests recently reported in a single day, far more than any country in the world has ever been able to do. And our numbers are actually going up. As these new and better testing solutions come online, we're seeing this additional capacity reflected in the numbers. For this reason, the number of tests processed in commercial laboratories has dropped from approximately 100,000 to roughly 75,000 tests over the last week. The reason it dropped is because we have so many other tests and we don't even have to go through the laboratories. But the laboratories have tremendous additional capacity, and states feel free to use that capacity. Some in the media falsely reported this as a bad thing, when in fact, it is a great thing. Now the American people are ready to rise to the occasion once again. They are ready to show the world once more that Americans can defeat any challenger. Together, we will rebuild this land that we love. We will reclaim the magnificent destiny that we share, and we will carry our nation forward to new heights of greatness and glory. I would now like to ask Vice President Mike Pence and Dr. Birx to further explain the new guidelines. I want to thank Dr. Birx. I want to thank Dr. Fauci. And I want to thank, really especially, a man who has devoted 24 hours a day to his task force and done such an incredible job, our great Vice President, Mike Pence. Please, Mike.
Thank you, Mr. President. The members of the White House Coronavirus Task Force today joined the President to meet with a bipartisan group of members of the House and of the Senate to get their counsel on the development of what the President unveiled to America's governors this afternoon. The new guidelines for opening up America again are a product of the best science and the best common sense that the President has marshaled on this team and from a broad range of advisors from all across the nation. From the moment President Trump established the White House Coronavirus Task Force, early on, he made it clear that we have no higher priority than the health and safety of the American people. The President launched a whole-of-government approach. And while we stand here on this day, with more than 640,000 Americans having contracted the coronavirus, and our hearts go out to the families of the more than 31,000 Americans who lost their lives and those who continue to struggle with serious consequences of the coronavirus. The truth is that because of the decisive action that our president took early on, suspending travel from China and thereafter from portions of Europe and South Korea, screening passengers, because of the strong actions in partnership with every governor across America, because of the extraordinary efforts of America's healthcare workers on the front lines, and because of the cooperation of the American people and God's grace, we are slowing the spread. We are flattening the curve. We have preserved the capacity of our healthcare system, and we've protected the most vulnerable. Guidelines, as Americans who are looking on will note, begin with what is the best criteria that our experts have developed: a downward trajectory in cases over a 14-day period of time, ensuring that states have proper capacity in their healthcare facilities. The second set of proposals includes a description of recommendations for state preparedness. And let me say to the American people what President Trump made clear to our governors today, that our administration will continue to work day in and day out through our task force, through FEMA, to ensure that our states have not only the medical supplies, but that we continue to rapidly expand testing across the nation. Finally, the President directed us to propose a phased approach to reopening our economy. It is based on up-to-date data and readiness. We'll continue to provide the very best data to our states, working with their health officials.
You'll recognize this slide is what we've been talking about in the 15 and 30 days to prevent the spread. It's continuing those critical hand washing or sanitizers, not avoiding touching your face at all times, disinfecting surfaces, using face covering while in public, following state and local guidelines, and critically, staying home if you are sick. I know a lot of people go to the workplace when they are feeling ill. You know when you're feeling ill. It won't get better by going to work. So we're asking again for people to stay home when they're sick. Next slide is for employers to ensure that there can be social distancing and protective equipment, temperature checks, use of disinfectant in high traffic areas, including break rooms, and ensuring that we don't do there's no non-essential business travel, and then monitoring for any symptomatic individuals in the workplace. And again, if you become ill at work, to immediately to go home. Ensure that there's contact tracing of all the individuals that become sick. I'm going to go through the phases very quickly, but you have the details. Phase one, again, you have to go through those gating criteria related to 14 days of decreasing evidence of illness and decreasing testing despite adequate testing. So phase one begins with all vulnerable individuals, including those with comorbidities, continuing to shelter in place and ensuring that those are the first go out into the public are not those that are most vulnerable to bad outcomes in this disease. And then ensuring that we continue to do 6 feet maximum physical distancing in public spaces, continuing to avoid large gatherings and all non-essential travel. For the employers, next slide. Again, if a vulnerable population needs to return to work and cannot be teleworking, there should be special accommodations for all vulnerable populations, as well as options for teleworking. We believe every employee should encourage work return in phases from 20% or 25% to 40% to 50%. And again, minimize all non-essential travel. Phase one continued. Next slide. If the schools are already closed, they should remain closed. All visits to senior living facilities and hospitals should be continue to be prohibited. Large venues, including sit-down dining, can only be operated under strict physical distancing protocols and maintaining those 6 feet. Gyms could open if they, again, could adhere to strict physical distancing, and elective surgeries can resume on an outpatient basis. Phase two. Next slide. Next slide. Again, you have to go through the criteria, again, of a continuation of another 14-day decline among those criteria that were in the gating. Again, we're asking for all vulnerable individuals shelter in place. We did not put a timeline on any of the phases. We want the governors, with the data that they have, community by community, to be setting up those timelines. Again, we're asking for the public to continue to maximize physical distance. However, we increased social settings to be able to now have 50 individuals, and non-essential travel can resume. Next slide. This is for the employers. We still would like to encourage telework, and the common areas should remain closed or be physically distanced. All non-essential travel for employees can resume. And then, again, special accommodations for vulnerable. Next slide. This should be a relief to many of households that have small children. Schools, daycares, and camps can reopen in phase two. Visits to senior living facilities, however, should remain in hospitals prohibited. Large venues can operate, but solely under moderate physical distancing, and elective surgeries can resume on an outpatient and inpatient basis. Phase three. And so phase three, I won't go through in detail, was essentially returning to our new normal with all of the what we talked about through all phases, continuing the good hygiene practices, continuing the respect for spaces between individuals, because we know that we still have an issue with asymptomatic spread. I do believe with this plan that we're both confronting the issue of finding symptomatic individuals through our networks with early alert, as well as those who come and present to different hospitals and emergency room with testing and contact tracing, but critically have put in place what we believe is a safety net through asymptomatic sentinel surveillance that is centered around our most vulnerable groups between nursing homes and Native American people and indigenous populations and our inner city groups that we know may be in multi-generational households and of unique risk. I'll stop there, Mr. President.
Thank you very much. Mr. President, Mr. Vice President. So as you've seen just now from the detailed presentation from Dr. Birx, this is a rather robust program for reentering into normality. There's a lot of details here, and I know it'll take a little bit of time to digest them all. So what I thought would be good, since I really want to be brief to allow time for questions, is to kind of take us back to the discussions that we've had here before and why this is a natural evolution from what we had said before. You might recall that on a few occasions when I was up here before you, I told you that when we get to the point where we're going to take those steps towards trying to get back to some form of normality, that it would not be a light switch that you could turn on and off. I meant that in two different components. The first of all, that we are a very large country and we have different dynamics in the country. We have areas of the country that have gone through a terrible ordeal and others that fortunately have gone and gotten through this rather lightly. So that's the first thing. The second thing is that light switch on and off is the exact opposite of what you see here, which is a gradual gradation with the first thing and the only thing in mind as the health people here, my colleagues who are either physicians, scientists, or public health issues, the predominant and completely driving element that we put into this was the safety and the health of the American public. And I know there are a lot of other considerations that go into opening, considerations that you've heard of right from this podium. But the dominating drive of this was to make sure that this is done in the safest way possible. So let me just make a couple of comments to just reiterate more from a broader standpoint the things that Dr. Birx did so well in a very granular detail. First of all, in order to even consider getting into the phasing, you have to pass a hurdle. And that's the hurdle that we refer to as gating in. Now, when you think about it and look at the map of the country and look at the differences in different parts of the country, you will see that there are some regions, states, locations that are going to be almost already into some of that gating and will have already fulfilled some of those criteria. Others, because of the dynamics of the outbreak in the area, will take longer to be able to do that. But you don't get to phase one until you get through the gating. And then in order to make sure that safety and health is the dominant issue, the design of the phases were just that. You go into phase one, if you get no rebound, and you satisfy the gating for yet again a second time, then you go to phase two. If you have no rebound and you satisfy the gating criteria for a third time, you go into phase three. So there are multiple checkpoints of safety there. So as I've said from this podium, when we were talking about the first 15 days of the mitigation, and then we extended it another 30 days, I essentially pleaded with the American public to say, let us make sure we do the best that we can to accomplish that. And in fact, mitigation works. You saw the charts that the Vice President and that Dr. Birx put up. It worked. And what we hope, and I believe we will be successful, if we carefully do this, again, with the attention to the safety and health of the American public, that we will be able to. It will be staggered. Not every state, not every region is going to do it at the same time. That's clearly obvious because of the very dynamics of the outbreak. But we feel confident that sooner or later, we will get to the point, hopefully sooner, with safety as the most important thing, to a point where we can get back to some form of normality.
During the question and answer portion, someone, I believe it was one of the reporters, asked Trump something to the effect, well, if you have a restaurant and their capacity was 110 people, and after all this is over, they can only have 30 people, how is that going to work for them? And if I recall correctly, Trump said, no. The idea is after all this is over and their capacity is 110 people, they can go to 110 people again. And I like that. I think that's really what you want. You want to get back to normal. Now, if there's a problem in your area where you're going to have an outbreak, yeah, you might have to make some adjustments there. But for the most part, that's the goal, is to get back to a normal. Now, they talk about a new normal with people staying 6 feet away from each other. This is not practical in a lot of places, bars, restaurants, movie theaters, sports arenas, a lot of places. And these are things that are going to have to be worked out. It's not going to happen immediately, but the idea is that we can go back to doing this when we're ready and when it's safe. Now let's listen to some excerpts of conservative radio talk show host Rush Limbaugh's take on the plan to reopen the country from his April 17 show the next day after this briefing. On the leftist-dominated media's hope they could find something to show dissension among the task force members and failure on the part of the president. He refers to Dr. Birx as the scarf queen because she always wears these neck scarves. In fact, I was surprised even to see a website about the many scarves she's seen in. Although last time I saw her, she didn't wear a scarf. and she looked fine. But anyway, okay, please play soundbite two.
So Catherine and I were chatting about the daily brief yesterday after the president announced the phased reopening plan for the country. And it has to happen. Folks, there is no delaying this any further. And you see all over the country now, people are revolting against certain state governors who want to maintain lockdown. It can't go on. This forced shutdown, the forced ruination of the United States economy must end. During the course of every day's busy broadcast, I have tried to convey my concern and fear for you, for all of us, for everybody. I mean, I've been there. I don't know how many of the people who are among our experts setting policy, I don't know how many of them have been broke. I don't know how many of them have been where 22 million Americans are, without a job, without any income, and unemployment compensation that just will not get it done. I don't know how many. There may be some. There may be great risk in reopening the country in phases. There may be great risk in sending people back out to start working, even under the guidelines. There are risks that have to be taken. Realize how, whatever length of time this task force has been up and running, there has not been one subversive leak. Not one. Not a single subversive leak. Not a single act or leak of sabotage. That's phenomenal. Think of all of the opportunities people on this task force had. Think there's a sympathetic media waiting out there, beating down the windows, beating down the doors, begging anybody, a staff member, an actual member of the task force, please, please, we know things can't be going this well. We know some of you have to think Trump's an idiot. Just tell us, just tell us. We promise you anonymity. The media trying to get leaks. The media trying, desperately trying for any negative story. Not one.
I'll have more to say, including some of the latest statistics on the pandemic, in a few minutes. But first, I'd like to play you more audio clips from video and audio that was featured on Breitbart.com over the past few days about the left's attempts to smear and blame the president for the pandemic's impact on the U.S. First, you'll hear longtime Trump hater, Democrat Representative Maxine Waters of California described by one watchdog group as one of the most corrupt members of Congress during an, as usual, deferential interview with her on MSNBC on April 9. Then there's CNN's Anderson Cooper on his program AC360 with yet another hit piece blaming the president for the effects of the coronavirus outbreak in the U.S. as he interviews Democrat Senator Chris Murphy of Connecticut. Murphy defends Communist China's and the World Health Organization's handling of the pandemic and blames Trump only for what happened in the U.S., I guess. So it sounds like. Lastly, we have the, for me, notorious leftist Noam Chomsky comparing Trump supporters with Germans adoring Hitler. Chomsky makes his comments in an interview on a TV program called Democracy Now!, which is associated with a television channel called Free Speech TV. If you've watched this channel, you realize they showcase stars of the left, such as Chomsky, Democratic Congresswoman Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, Senator Bernie Sanders, and CNN commentator and Democratic political activist Van Jones. This channel also presented a documentary extolling the supposed virtues of the Soviet Union and declaring it had many great accomplishments during its existence. Play soundbite three, please.
You've served in Congress for a long time. You've seen different congressional caucuses come and go, different leadership structures, different presidents. Does it strike you? I'm sure curious how it strikes you to watch Republicans who, during the Obama administration, particularly, everything was austerity. It was, where's the money coming from? How are you going to pay for that? Today, just say, hey, we got to load up another $250 billion. Let's have a vote on it today. A striking turnabout, it seems to me.
Absolutely, because they understand that not only are the people that Democrats care about the least of these, people who are working on minimum wages, now what you have businesses of all sizes that are being jeopardized by what is going on. And so when you see the Fed roll out with a new program that they refer to as, the Main Street program, where they're saying that it is targeted toward mid-sized banks and bigger businesses, as well as the smaller businesses, they have a lot of people who are being jeopardized by this pandemic that we're experiencing. And they better stand up for them, because already history is recording every step that we make. And the president doesn't look too good. He has confused people. He sent the wrong messages. He has been given advice that he should not give it. And so now I think that perhaps they believe that they can wipe away that history. But I want to tell you, it's going to remain recorded, and we're going to fight for everything. And those Republicans who are getting in line and who are fighting with us, understand it's not just people that they think undeserving that are getting help. It is all across this country in all of our congressional districts, big and small and middle sized and all of that.
We've been discussing the president's criticism of the World Health Organization this evening, accusations of delayed actions and a lack of candor, perhaps not surprisingly, charges which echo the exact criticisms being leveled at the president. On Monday, he began the news conference with a campaign-like video attempting to show how much the president has been on top of the coronavirus response. It ended up documenting how little he did during the critical month of February. The president said he did a lot at that time, though he couldn't name anything of substance yesterday when asked. It's the kind of stuff he was doing. This is the kind of stuff he was doing and saying in February, downplaying the virus. Joining us now to talk about missed opportunities, Democratic Senator Chris Murphy of Connecticut. Senator Murphy, I want to read you a tweet that you tweeted out February 5th about the White House's response at that time. You said, just left the administration briefing on coronavirus. Bottom line, they aren't taking this seriously enough. Notably, no request for any emergency funding, which is a big mistake. Local health systems need supplies, training, screening, staff, etc., and they need it now. What did you see in that meeting? I mean, what was the problem?
That attitude was reflected in the meeting. Inside that meeting in early February were the president's top coronavirus experts. It was led by then Chief of Staff Mulvaney and Secretary of HHS Alex Azar. And they were just incredibly confident that they had beaten coronavirus. At that time, there were only a few cases here. They were reflecting what the president said in those clips because they thought that the travel bans had kept it out of the United States. We told them that they needed money, and they needed money fast in order to buy supplies, in order to hire more staff. And they told us that they didn't need any funding, that they had everything that they needed. And I walked out of that closed-door briefing just with chills running down my spine, because many of us on both sides of the aisle knew what this virus had done in China. We knew it was a matter of time before it arrived here, and it was just shocking how cavalier the administration was. This was at a time when the president really, you know, viewed this as a hoax. He said so on TV, and the reason that we're in the crisis that we are today is not because of anything that China did. It's not because of anything the WHO did. It's because of what this president did. It's because he didn't take this virus seriously. We weren't going to be able to keep every case out of the United States, but we didn't have to have tens of thousands of people dying.
This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the Quarantine Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The death rate from the coronavirus pandemic continues to accelerate, with worldwide confirmed deaths topping 145,000. In the United States, deaths surged to another record high Thursday, nearly doubling to surpass the previous record set just a day before at 4,591 U.S. residents died over a single 24-hour period. Well, today we continue my conversation with Noam Chomsky, the world-renowned political dissident, linguist, and author of more than 100 books. He's a laureate professor in the Department of Linguistics at the University of Arizona, Tucson, and professor emeritus at Massachusetts Institute of Technology, where he taught for more than half a century. Professor Chomsky joined us last week from his home in Tucson, Arizona, where he is sheltering in place with his wife, Valeria. We spoke just after President Donald Trump foreshadowed this week's announcement that he would cut off U.S. support for the World Health Organization. This is Trump addressing reporters last week.
Is the time to freeze funding to the WHO during a pandemic?
No, maybe not. I mean, I'm not saying I'm going to do it, but we're going to look at it.
You did say
we give a tremendous no, I didn't. I said we're going to look at it. We're going to investigate it. We're going to look at it.
Can you talk about what he's threatening to do right now? First, they reject the WHO tests that would have been critical, and now saying they're going to defund the World Health Organization.
Well, this is typical
behavior of autocrats and dictators. When you make colossal errors, which are killing thousands of people, find somebody else to blame. And in the United States, it's unfortunately the case for well over a century, century and a half, that it's always easy to blame the yellow peril. The yellow, they're coming after us. We've seen this all through my life, in fact, way before. So blame the World Health Organization, blame China, claim that the World Health Organization is has insidious relations with China, is practically working for them. And that sells to a population that's been deeply indoctrinated for a long time, way back to the Chinese Exclusion Acts in the 19th century, to say, yeah, those yellow barbarians are coming over to destroy us. That's almost instinctive. And it's backed up by the echo chamber. So, say Rush Limbaugh, science is one of the four corners of deceit, along with media, academia, forget one of the others, but they're the four corners of deceit. They live on deceit. You keep driving that into people's heads. They say, why should we believe anything? Why should we believe the news? It's just fake news. They're all trying to destroy our savior, our president, the greatest president ever. It's I'm old enough to remember as a child listening to Hitler speeches over the radio, Nuremberg rallies. I couldn't understand the words, but the tone and the reaction of the crowd, the adoring crowd, was very clear, very frightening. We know what it led to. It's hard to, it comes to mind at once when you listen to Trump's ravings in the crowd.
Yeah, he went on to say that he didn't think Trump was, I believe he said anything like Hitler, but you know. And of course, if you listen to some of the other stuff, the critical month of February, well, I've seen quotes from Fauci, I've seen quotes from Birx in late February saying this is, or mid to late February, saying this is not a problem, we have everything we need, we're okay. They were advising the president, I believe, at that time. Fauci had said himself, the one and only time he recommended that we go into this lockdown stuff, Trump was amenable to it. Trump listened and agreed, went along with it. It just goes on and on. It's not difficult to manipulate facts and events, bending them and selectively using them to support your point of view. Don't get me wrong, we all use information to support our views, but it's crucial that people understand what and where they are getting their information from in order to make judgments about those sources and get to the truth. For example, Anderson Cooper uses information to make it look like the president did nothing during the crucial month, the critical month, as he says, of February, when other top officials in the government were also led to believe the coronavirus outbreak in China and elsewhere was not as big a threat as they later came to see it as. You had House Speaker Nancy Pelosi being interviewed on television as late as February 24th, touring San Francisco's Chinatown and urging people to come and join her there, claiming it was perfectly safe to do so. Trump, by the way, had banned flights from non-citizens from China in late January when there was a concern about this. And at the time he was berated in the media as being racist and xenophobe. This is the standard tactic they use. And Noam Chomsky plays the race card, contending that U.S. officials being critical of China and the World Health Organization's handling of the pandemic are racist and engaging in scare tactics by invoking the, quote, yellow peril, unquote, whatever that means, when in fact I have never heard any of these critics say any such thing or even imply it. No one that I know of is blaming or has blamed Chinese Orientals in general for the pandemic. You might find it interesting that, according to the online encyclopedia Wikipedia, Chomsky is often described as one of the best-known figures of the American left, although he doesn't agree with the usage of the term. He's a renowned linguist, and he knows about meanings of words. That's what linguism is, I believe, he has described himself as a, quote, fellow traveler, unquote, to the anarchist tradition, Wikipedia says, and refers to himself as a libertarian socialist, a political philosophy he summarizes as challenging all forms of authority and attempting to eliminate them if they are unjustified, for which the burden of proof is solely upon those who attempt to exert power. He identifies with labor-oriented anarcho-syndicalist, with the labor-oriented anarcho-syndicalist current of anarchism, Wikipedia says, in particular cases, and is a member of the Industrial Workers of the World. Boy, there are a lot of communists involved with it, aren't they? Anyway, Chomsky seems to always come down on the side of the radical left, but doesn't like to be considered a leftist. And I can understand that. I can understand why he would say why he wouldn't. The ridiculous assertions of racism by Chomsky aside, there's good reason to investigate the situation with that wonderful globalist United Nations institution, the World Health Organization, and communist China. As I understand it, the WHO, whose chief was installed with the support of communist China, has been laudatory of China's handling of the outbreak. It has been reported that China deliberately downplayed the outbreak at first and then, realizing its seriousness, halted all travel into and out of the epicenter, Wuhan, China, within its own country, within China, while continuing to allow foreign travel into and out of Wuhan. On the domestic side, radio host Mark Levin has reported that the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention has been advising doctors that if they are unable to attribute a patient's death to something else, they should attribute it to coronavirus. And White House Coronavirus Task Force Coronavirus Response Coordinator Dr. Deborah Birx has stated that authorities also are advising that anyone who dies with coronavirus is to be determined to have died as a result of coronavirus rather than more directly from any underlying health condition. These matters raise doubts that the official figures on coronavirus deaths are accurate. When I checked the websites earlier today, the WHO reported that as of today, April 19th, there have been 2,241,359 cases of coronavirus reported worldwide, and 152,551 deaths. The CDC reports that preliminary figures as of yesterday, April 18th, show that there were 690,714 cases of coronavirus in the U.S. and 35,443 deaths. Despite the overall rising number of deaths being attributed to coronavirus in the U.S., most jurisdictions are reporting declines in the number of new cases, as I understand it. Rush Limbaugh has stated that 98% of the people dying after having contracted coronavirus had serious underlying health disorders. I heard a physician on another radio program state that normally what you do if someone had died directly of kidney failure or heart attack and had coronavirus, you would report it as such on the death certificate and state that coronavirus was a contributing factor. But that's not what's being done here. Coronavirus is the direct result of that, according to the medical authorities. Limbaugh has reported that 90% of people contracting the disease recover from it, some showing no symptoms whatsoever. That's also been reported elsewhere, I believe, while others become quite ill with disease. I read today on a website that 80% of the people have mild symptoms and recover from the disease. Some 15% have more serious effects from it, suffer more serious effects from it, and 5% have life-threatening situations. These are things we need to consider and discuss in detail while we work to recover as a nation from the coronavirus pandemic. We're going to have to live with this disease for many years to come, and it's vital that we have all the facts and the truth to deal with it and to live with it without letting it destroy us. I hope you found the show of value. We'll be back 2 weeks from today. Till then, take care and all the best.